Good evening, James McKenney here with My Science Hour. This is for June 23rd, 2022, in the ongoing year-long series of the history of the discoveries of my work. And once again, this is not a series of lectures on my work and on the details of the discoveries, etc. This is on the history, putting everything into perspective on a timeline. First, want to mention, I talked about this before, I think it was last week, the importance of man. When you take all of the material, the matter in the universe, and all the processes, and all the complications, and all the consistencies, and understanding that our side of the universe, when we look out and take spectrum of the other side of the universe, it is exactly the same as ours here. And so it just tells you that this is very uniform. It's not something random that just kind of blew out of nowhere and all of a sudden happened one day by accident, as the standard astronomical community would have you believe. But the whole issue is, when you come back to all of this, in a sense, is like the Copernican timepiece, where everything is like a clock and it's running, etc. The only thing that is not like that is biological life, and of course, leading up to man. And intelligent being, of which man supposedly is one. But the other thing is that there is a spirit associated with man, and so that sets him aside from the animals, the animal kingdom. And so the other thing is that man can feel emotions and direct traffic in his life, can create things, change his environment. And there are no other animals that really study quantum physics or science or make measurements or build spacecraft or build automobiles or build roads. You have some birds that, you know, replicate nests, a very primitive form of organization. But they really, in, you know, and you can see animals caring for their young, which is a very natural trait also. But there's something different about the human condition, if you want to call it that, in that we can understand through offspring and grandparents and other relatives and other humans, we can understand the creator as it fills up the intelligence that we see all around us. Animals don't do that. They don't look up at the stars and wonder about going there someday. They're just preoccupied with what's around them, and they react to their environment. That's very different. Man reacts to his environment, and there's a lot of people who live by animal instincts. They never get off that plane. They never get above it. They never get up to any level of a spiritual plane, and there are all kinds of levels of spiritual planes, and I probably have not hit many myself. But the point is that, now I'm going to make a statement, I think most scientists and engineers that I've met in my life, very good scientists, very well educated, etc., but I would venture to say that very few of them have ever had a real love experience. And that when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about, say, a husband or wife or that kind of experience. They go through the motions. They have kids. They do have emotions, but they never see through that as a part of a greater cosmic plan. You know, they go shopping. They do all the right things. They send their kids to school. They try and have them get good grades. All of these superficial things, 99% of which really don't matter. But they never, ever get beyond that. And so anyway, I think it's important to, when I, for example, went out into the wilderness, not only in Canada, but other times in the jungles, when I went out for extended periods of time by myself and just, you know, was, as I said, dealing with myself and nature and looking into this cosmos and understanding the position of man in the cosmos, etc., and the infinite complications, but the simplicity, which led me to major discoveries like the prime number problem. Solving that was part and parcel. This was very important. And last week, by the way, I talked about being in the telecommunications industry and understanding the importance of encryption because I worked in that field. I was probably a world-class expert in encryption, computer protocols, both the electronic side of it and the signaling side of it and the performance side of it. How do these things have to transpire, these messages going back and forth so that they're delivered properly? And how can you encrypt them so nobody can tap into it and steal your information, etc.? But the point is that without having that connection to the universe, I would probably never have solved the prime number problem, because I would not have made the correct assumptions that led me to the solution, because I had to understand how nature works. And just imagine, thousands of years of mathematicians could not do that, but I could, because I understood how nature worked. Okay, so enough of that. But also, I'm not telling a lot of personal things about my life. This is a history of my scientific work, and in some cases was influenced by people that I knew and relationships that I may have had, things like that. But I'm not talking about, I'm really leaving that out, because I think it's best to just understand the essentials relative to the scientific discoveries. Okay. So anyway, I left off last week. I'm gainfully unemployed all of a sudden after 10 years of having a really, really good job. And this job should have blossomed, but somebody had something else in mind for me. I had some other routes that I still had to take and some other things that I had to do and not be buried in this cubicle in a corporation. There were some other things I had to go out and expand once again. So being gainfully unemployed, at that point I had just purchased a new house. My house payment was not outlandishly high, but still I had to earn money to pay that, and the utilities and things like that. So I went out and I started 5 businesses. And I said, and I really thought that, the idea was that I started 5 businesses, one of these is going to succeed. And it was a time like one of these cycled layoffs where they were called corporate raiders. And these guys would come in and they would go to the bank and they'd say, I want to target this company here. I want to buy it. I'm going to sell off all its assets, which are estimated to be so many, say, $100 million. And then I'll pay back the bank loan, and then we'll split the profit. And then they would also, at the time they were moving, this is when the big surge of movement of corporations and manufacturing was going to China. And so they were called corporate raiders. That's what they were doing. And this went on, and Congress just let it happen. Let them destroy the infrastructure of the United States for a few people making profit purely out of greed. Purely out of greed, destroying the lives of millions of people. We saw this also in the housing crisis, economic downturns, and even as I speak right now, there's a full-blown effort underway to destroy the United States, throwing inflation, runaway inflation that has only been seen in third world countries, now hitting the United States. They're turning the United States into a third world country. And so that was the same conditions in 1990-91. This is also when Harrington, of course, discovered Planet X. And this had an amazingly huge impact on the intelligence communities. George Bush Sr., who had been head of the CIA, and of course his father big in banking, the Schiffs, that came from Germany to set up the banking, and also in to set up the CIA, Operation Paperclip, to bring all the German scientists into the United States and take over the United States government, operating through the Federal Reserve. Okay, so anyway, but the scientific world was undergoing massive changes also, because in the background, imagine this, from 1991, when Planet X was finally confirmed, and they knew that this was on a near direct collision course with Earth, and they did not know it was going to become the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, this massive comet that was publicly discovered July 15th, 1995. So there's a four-year span, almost five-year span in there, where the intelligence communities were busy in the background getting ready for this disaster, this worldwide disaster that they knew was coming. And it was to happen in about 1997, when the closest approach of Hale-Bopp, when it passed through the ecliptic and about 1 million miles away from where Earth should have been. But the tail drag, unbeknownst to the astronomers and scientists at the time who advised the CIA, because the CIA isn't a scientific group, they're an intelligence group, not very intelligent, but an intelligence group, they are the police force of the World Bank, were prepping the world, basically getting everything in order. So if this turned out to be a major disaster, they would be ready. So the underground tunnels were being built, the political structure was being built, the banking systems were being hardened so they could come out the other side no matter what the event was to be, etc. And also the fact that the history of these kinds of events was known to these people, because at least the people that were very high up. And I don't even know if George Bush Sr. knew all of the details that were known through the Vatican, the Jesuits in the Vatican who had taken over. The Jesuits were the converted Jews who were in Spain who converted to Catholicism during the Spanish Inquisition, but then went underground and basically kept their secret societies going. I talk about this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And the world now is being prepped. Also, there's a massive disinformation campaign that's coming out of that, which leads up to the May 15th, 2003, big full moon, big orange full moon that was to rise. Now, we just had one past month on, May 15th also, but of the year 2022, so 19 years later to the day, literally, where this cycle, but that's not the normal cycle of the red moon, the red full moon, but these were relatively close together because this red moon is very, very rare, called a wolf moon, etc. But anyway, the idea was that this crazy lady talks to aliens, predicts that on May 15, 2003, there's going to be Planet X is going to come and we're all going to die. And on the cover of her book is this big orange ball. Well, the only people that really could have predicted that far in advance, as early as the 1990s, the early 1990s that I'm talking about, would have been professional astronomers. They would have known about this upcoming red moon. And the other thing is that it would have occurred just at sundown, as the moon was coming up and rising off the horizon. So it would have been, which it was, this spectacular full moon. Well, anyway, I'm not going to go into more detail on it. I'm talking about the period of 1991 to 95, when all of this preparation and disinformation and getting the governments and hardening the tunnels and getting the presidency handed off from George Bush Sr. to Billy Clinton. And I've already talked about this many times, Dan Golden coming in from the CIA to put the lid on NASA. I saw the people at NASA because I knew firsthand, knew by first name, many, probably most of the people at Goddard, some of the people at JPL, probably most of the people at Los Alamos, knew them by first name. And saw all of these changes going on. It was a radical change right in that time period of 1991. And at the time, I did not know what was going on or why, but I could see it. Okay, so anyway, there's a time frame when I'm gainfully unemployed. So I started four businesses, and I'm not going to go through what I started five businesses. Four of them didn't do very well. But the one did, and I'll talk about that a little bit. It's a piece of history that I'll go into a little bit of my personal life. And the whole issue with this is it's a technical business that I developed. Something I actually did when I was a kid, a young kid, and I'll start out by talking about this. When I was young, I was fascinated with archery, and I'm not sure why. It's just one of those things some kids really like the idea of the bow and arrow, you know. And some of the very interesting books throughout history, the English term for archery has to do with simply watching the arrow fly. And there's certain fascination of this arrow coming out of the bow and watching it fly through the air and hit the ground or whatever you target, whatever you're shooting at, etc. So there's a certain fascination. And so my career, if you want to call it that, my beginning in archery was when my dad brought home a piece of hickory. And it was probably kiln dried, which is not very good for archery. It makes it brittle, or any wood would become brittle. Archery equipment is typically made with air dried, is because it doesn't get dry and brittle. It's more flexible, etc. But anyway, be that as it may, there was a company in my little town where I grew up that made trucks and equipment for warehouses, you know, the kind of trucks that you put goods on and move them around a warehouse. Anyway, one of the woods that they were using was hickory. So my dad brings home this probably 2x2 and 5 foot long piece of hickory. So I make a bow out of this, and I don't have any tools. The only tool I have is a hand rasp, which is a very gross, coarse file. And so I work on this and work on this, and I go down to the library and I get a book that shows you how to taper the bow, etc. And then, of course, I really didn't know that you can't just bend this thing the first time. It has to be worked into shape. But anyway, so it broke near the middle. It just split. It didn't completely break in two. And so my dad went down, got some steel, very fine steel braided cord, and wrapped this and then put solder on it. And that kind of made it, really fixed it. And so I went on to use this. And then I made a string according to the directions. And then I didn't have any arrows, so I had to make my own arrows. And this was my bow. And my friend, I had a friend who had, his dad was a very ardent archer. He went deer hunting with a bow and was a very good shot, and et cetera. So my friend had very nice bows, which I got to use occasionally. He would loan me one. And so, but anyway, my bow was this little homemade hickory bow. Then later on, I went on to make a crossbow using a leaf spring from a car and made the stock out of oak. And it was a lever to cock it, because crossbows are typically too strong to pull the string back and put it into the trigger mechanism. I cut the trigger mechanism by hand out of a solid block of steel with a hacksaw. And both of these projects took almost a complete summer, and of course not working 24/7. But anyway, that was my beginning in archery. So when I became gainfully unemployed, I'm like, okay, I got to do something here. I have responsibilities. I have to keep up with my house payment. I don't want to lose my house, etc. So I converted my garage and part of my basement into this little factory. And the other four businesses, as I say, I'm not going to mention what they were. They were just, you know, selling things, etc. And they did not pan out, but the bow business did. And so it went on to to provide income for me for a number of years. And I'll just insert at this point a little bit about my total history of employment, what I would call real jobs, if you want to call them jobs or positions or positions. And so right now I'm my history I had of I have two careers in a sense that I had throughout my career. One of them was teaching physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy at the university level. So that accounts for 10 years, and then aside from that, 25 years in the telecommunications industry. So from 1982 to 1990, I would say about 90, was a period of about 10 years if you span the both of those years and go into 91 when the actual layoff occurred that I was in. So I just say rounding up very close to 10 years at that very high level design work in telecommunications, encryption, communication protocols, very high level work in the computer industry as a principal systems engineer, designing this and working with the engineers who actually built the equipment and maintaining all the consistencies with old equipment to new equipment, writing functional specification, hardware design specifications, etc., which also helped me out when I got up to my work on the wing generation, because the wing generator, which I invented in the 2000s, because I knew how to write a functional specification. And just quickly, back in the good old days of real engineering, something that rarely happens anymore, the functional specification was the first document to be written when you planned a product, an engineering, a complex engineering product. And what that was a set of guidelines and limits and definitions of what this thing had to do. And it did not have anything to do with the physical size or other things. It was more all of the parameters that had to be the guidelines for this product. And so in the design, when I went to write a hardware design specification from the functional specification, then the details of the hardware specification had to stay within the limits and boundaries, etc., of the functional specification. And so these were consistent documents. But when I got to the wing generator and designing it, I realized that, I'm going to jump ahead to the year, let's say 2004, 2005. I was living in Minnesota at the time. Gainfully employed as a in the telecommunications industry. But I was asked by a local company that was dealing with energy, alternative energy, and by the way, they were doing conversion of corn and other grains into alcohol, into ethanol. That was their business. And they asked me to do a study of Xcel Energy, this company that spanned something like 14 states and provided energy. They were starting to become big in the three-blade wind turbine and solar industry. That's where it was really taking off, and they were starting to install a fairly large base of three-blade wind turbines. And this little company said, James, please take your physics background and do an overall efficiency study of this electric power company. So I did. And then at the very end, when I came back with my study, they said, well, you know, the real thing we want here is to study three-blade wind turbines and solar, and we want to, because they wanted to know how to invest intelligently in these upcoming technologies. When they wanted to, they were talking about already replacing coal, which was the primary fuel, and nuclear, because the Xcel Energy had two nuclear plants. And so they were talking about replacing all of this with three-blade wind turbines and solar. So I did my study, and I came back, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this junk does not work, and it will never work. It will never replace the main sources of electrical energy, coal, nuclear, natural gas, which was just starting to come online at that time in the early 2000s. And so I came back to this company and I said, wow, you know, this don't invest in this. It's not going to work. And I explained why, that the three-blade wind turbine, 95% of the wind just blows right through it. And as you make them bigger, the problem becomes worse. And I made some calculations regarding solar panels. And basically, the issue with solar panels is the sun only shines a few hours of the day, and you only get a certain amount of energy, and the rest of the time they are dormant. They're not doing anything. And then if you add in the cost of batteries, even in sometimes in physics or physics problems, you go to the extreme. And so I said, what if you could make a solar panel that cost a penny and it was 100% efficient? In other words, it took all of the sunlight and converted it into electrical energy. Would that product be profitable? And the answer I came back with was no. It would not be profitable because the sun only shines so many hours a day. That means if you're really going to power your network with, or your grid with solar power, then you need batteries and the cost of batteries, the installation, the maintenance, and everything else that goes with batteries is simply prohibitive, and it never will, even if you could invent a battery that somehow was highly efficient and did not wear out, etc. And all of these really wonderful parameters everybody's trying to get to with batteries, it still would not be a viable system because of the amount of ground space you would have to cover with solar panels. Solar panels just will not work for broad scale electricity. And people are trying to do this because basically they get government subsidies. If it were not for government subsidies, none of those businesses would be there. So I came back to the company, the little company that hired me, and said, I gave them the results. And then I went home and I said, you know, solar isn't going to work because the sun only shines a certain part of the day. The one source of energy that will work will be wind. And so anyway, I'll talk more about this when we get there. But the point is, when I sat down to design the wing generator, which came out of all of this, I wrote a functional specification. And my experience that I gained in the 1980s, writing functional specifications for electronic equipment, came into play because now I wrote a functional specification for a wind energy system that would make 25 improvements over the three-blade monsters that are all over dotting the countryside. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to make that clear that, okay, so what I was, when I started this kind of diversion, what I was talking about was 25 years in the telecommunications industry. So I'm going to just summarize this now. Once again, by the time we get to 1990, I'm gainfully unemployed. I'm starting another company, this archery company. At that point, I had 4 years of teaching in a foreign university. And that's, by the way, where I gained my title professor. It was a legitimate title that I gained by teaching in this university. And that was one of the steps, if you remember, then when I talked about getting my job at Cornell for 2 years. So that's 4 years and plus two, that's 6 years of university teaching. And then I ended up, after in this time period when I was gainfully unemployed, I also taught electronics at a professional school. And I taught transistor logic and solid state electronics, etc. And so I taught that, and that I include in my resume as university level teaching electronics, which also I was in Cornell. If you remember, my very first position at Cornell was in an electronics course, besides the physics, kind of the basic physics 101, etc. Okay, so then the 10 years, my point is that all adds up. And then I had 2.5 years I taught in the state university system. I taught physics and astronomy. And this was very interesting because they came to me and I was teaching physics at the state university system. And they came to me and they said, we need somebody to teach astronomy. I said, well, yeah. And it was an elective course, so they did not need somebody with, a PhD in astronomy. The physics person who had been teaching astronomy before couldn't do it anymore for some reason. So I said, sure, I'll teach astronomy. So I go in and I teach astronomy. This is in this 1991 to 1995 time frame. So I start teaching astronomy. In my first year class, my first semester class, was about 30 students. And then word got out that this was really a good class. And so the next, they were on a quarter system, because the state university system was on a quarter system. My next quarter, I had 60 students in my class. And so they split it into two classes. By the third semester, word had gotten out, I had 195 students sign up for my class. So they divided it up into various classrooms. So I'm teaching physics and then these big classes of astronomy, which was primarily an elective. It was a way for students to get a science elective, which they needed for their bachelor's degree that came out of the university system. And so I have 195 students in my astronomy class. So it's really ironic that I have to teach astronomy and out of a textbook, which I know is totally bogus. And so anyway, every now and then I tell the students, I said, I got to teach this, but this is really not what's going on. And so two things came out of that. One is that the school had grant money. And the grant money was for production, video production, assisted learning production, etc. And so I applied and I got this grant to do a video for astronomy. And that's where, if you look on my video list of the DVD number 1 and 2, and these are hard DVDs that are available on my webpage in my library sets, they are part of the remastered DVDs, etc. And it's called Astronomy for the 90s. And what I did in my astronomy class, let me quick summarize this, first of all, these years of work. So what I'm saying is these 3 years where I taught in the university system plus another year teaching electronics amounts for 10 years. And so I say on my resume that I have 10 years of teaching. So it's teaching physics, mathematics, just about every mathematics course there is, including engineering mathematics, astronomy, computer science, and electronics. And that's on my resume. And then I also say that I have 25 years in the telecommunications industry, which is the first 10 years was the 1980s when I was gainfully employed for a period of 10 years at the high-level design group where we made the IBM front-end processors. And then later, starting in around 1996, for 15 years, I worked in the telecommunications industry, once again, a high-security job, which kept me hidden and allowed me to do my science work. And I had, once again, gainfully employed. I had a very nice salary, high security. So when I went into the building, it was you needed your badge to get in the building, etc. And so it was completely hidden from the people who would come after me and destroy my livelihood. Okay, so anyway, just in summary, 10 years of teaching physics, math, computer science, astronomy, and electronics at the university level, and then 25 years in the telecommunications industry. And those are my real jobs that I talk about. And then also I've had businesses. Of course, now I have my water filter business. I have the wing generator business. I have other businesses. You can see them on the webpage, etc. But I'm talking about in this 1991 to 95 period where I started this archery business. So I'm going to jump back to that because it's very important. It goes back in the history of the Celts. Now the Celts, which I later found out too, and this is some things that I learned later on, were my ancestors. And because my ancestors, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, curly blonde hair with white skin, My true ancestors were Vikings, and they came and they settled the northern and western bays of Ireland and became the predecessors of the Celts. Now, these were the Israelites that came out of Moses, came out of Egypt with Moses, and eventually populated northern Europe and went up into the what we call the Scandinavian countries today, and also in the Caucasians. That's where the term Caucasian comes from, and then into Ireland, from the mainland, from northern Europe, and then also from the Vikings coming down. And this took thousands of years of migration to take place. But anyway, the Celts were the ones who invented archery. So somehow it had in my blood to do this archery thing. From the time I was a little kid, I was fascinated. And then there's kind of another little story. I don't talk here much about my parents, but they were very wonderful people. My dad was a mechanic in World War II. He was older than most, so when he went to England, he was a mechanic on B-17s in World War II, and of course, I learned about that. My aunt, on my mother's side, was one of the first nurses into Auschwitz, which I learned about that, and also learned that it was not just Jews there, that these were political prisoners from all over Europe that were placed in these places because of political reasons. But my father had been a mechanic on B-17s in England during the war, and then, of course, came back, and I was a war baby. So, you know, what do they call a boomer? After the World War II, there was this boom of babies, and I was part of that. But anyway, I used to watch him as a kid, and he had very meticulous writing, very neat, etc., and they were very strict on studying. And so I grew up, in a sense, in a very strict Catholic environment. I went to private school, grade school, high school, college, etc., and the thing was that it was very strict as far as studying. And so I had my desk. When I was in high school, I had a desk that my father had brought back. It was an old disc card from a post office, big, heavy-duty oak desk with all of these shelves that extended up in the back of it where they would sort mail, I guess. But then we put a very hard surface on it because the surface had been kind of destroyed over the years of use in the post office, the old post office, when they remodeled it. And then put a very hard surface on that, and that was my desk in high school, where I'd go up to my room by myself in the middle of the winter when it was perfectly quiet and study mathematics and physics for hours and hours on end, developing my concentration skills, something that doesn't happen today. But anyway, back to the archery issue. I didn't have tools. We were not rich. We had enough. We had food, we had heat, we had clothes, all the essentials, but not a lot of extra things. So in the case where I wanted my bow, I literally had to make it. But this came into play later during these 1990 years. And I'm just going to another little anecdote here. When I was a kid, my father recognized my interest in archery. And so he went out and he saved up and bought me, I think it was for my birthday, I'm not quite sure, maybe Christmas or something, and bought me a bear recurve bow, a 40-pound, which would have been legal hunting bow in those days, a 40-pound bow, bought me this bow. And I'm like, wow, this was one of the nicest presents I ever got. But anyway, be that as it may, it developed this interest in archery. And so, by the way, I still have that bow. So now I'm in 1991. I'm gainfully unemployed. And so I thought, out of interest, I went out and I bought some structural red elm, was one of the woods that was used in Old England to make archery equipment. A lot of people think, well, it was yew. That was correct. For a lot of the war bows and the artillery bows that were used in warfare, the bows were made of yew. But there was a limited supply of yew, and the English archers got their yew from the Pyrenees Mountain, which divides Spain and Europe. And so the division of labor, now in Old England, all of the people, all of the men on Sundays would go out and they would shoot at what were called the butts. A butt was a big pile of dirt, and it was called clout shooting. So what they would do is they would get their team of archers and they would shoot and concentrate the arrows on a certain area. In other words, if there was anybody in that area, horses or other enemy or whatever, they would all be dead. Because these were shooting very... And so I learned about the physics of medieval archery. And one of the issues was the bodkin tips, the armor-piercing tips, and the flight of the arrows. Now, these were like 150, 200-pound bows. And I started making these, and I started a business selling these. And I went to different events and things like that, and people were buying them. And it may not sound like much, but I was making about $35,000 to $40,000 a year making Old English archery equipment, replica. So it was all, there was a woman that I knew who wove the flax string, linen strings. And so everything was authentic. The arrows were authentic. I had the gray goose feathers that I hand tied to the shaft, etc. And and so anyway, I ran this business and eventually got to the point where I was doing it as artwork. I was invited to art contests because the beautiful display, and people literally bought it as a wall hanging because it had the quiver, the old English quiver with the arrows, the gray goose feathers in it, the bodkin tips and the extra string. And a lot of terms from archery are used in modern day life, like in sports. When you have a group of teams that go out there, you call it your first string. Well, that comes from Old English archery, because when the archers went into battle, they had the various strings for their bow. And when you went into battle, you did not want a broken string, because that could mean also a broken bow. And so you used your first string. And so that's where the term first string comes from. And all of these other terms. So I learned about this. I learned about Celtic history, which helped me later as I started to learn more and more about the true story of Moses and the Israelites, and the fact that the Hebrews were not Jews. They were Hebrews. They were Israelites. And the people that came out of Egypt with Moses were Israelites. They were blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white-skinned. And when they emerged from the crossing of the Red Sea, etc., the parting of the sea, and they crossed, and all of this, they eventually wandered in the desert. And this was during the Venus event. So anyway, it pulled together a lot of things in history that I had known about. But the fact that the Celts, who were my ancestors from Norway, who settled in Ireland and developed the longbow, which then was used by the English and dominated, that's why the English dominated at sea, for example, for hundreds of years, because the English archers would get up into the rigging of the ship and you'd have maybe 20 or 30 archers up in the rigging as they approached another ship. And of course, there were cannons going off and things like that. But the archers were very good shots. They were professional. And they would clear the deck. Anybody that was up on deck was dead. So when the British came to board a ship, they had nobody on the deck to resist them. They could cover the ship. They could take it over, drop the sails. And that is one of the main reasons the English established their dominance on the ocean for hundreds of years, once again, was because of the archers. By the way, when Ben Franklin went to the United States was forming and they were determining what kind of weapons they should use for militia, the Benjamin Franklin said archery because it works in the rain. The old flintlock guns, single shot, long time to reload. If it's raining, the powder gets wet, doesn't work. Archery works in the rain, works in the sunshine, whatever. It's a in the rapid fire. It's a much better weapon than a single shot musket. Okay, so anyway, I'm getting a little far afield here, but I'm just kind of filling in the blanks of this business I created. And then the last episode of this, I took my not the biggest bow, which was basically a 6 foot. I called it the war bow. But the next size down, and I took it to a group of people in California who started at that time making, this is in the early 1990s, they had been doing government contract work for military, and it was one of those slow periods, and so these guys went out and started making golf shafts out of carbon fiber. It was the first wave of carbon fiber to be introduced into the golf industry. And so I approached these guys and I said, you know, I've got archery equipment here and what I'd like to do is design archery equipment out of carbon fiber. So I made literally the first carbon fiber archery equipment. But carbon fiber is very interesting in that it doesn't have compressive strength. When you bend a bow, archery bow, the side that's towards you gets compressed because you're bending it towards you, and the far side gets stretched. And so that's like on a U-bow, you use the outside softer wood of the U-tree for the stretch part, and you use the inner compression part for the inner, the harder wood on the inner part of the tree for the compression part. But carbon fiber, in the same way with other types of bows or bow wood, you would do the same thing. But carbon fiber does not have any compressive strength at all. It has tensile strength. And so what they did is they developed a technique that they were using, the same technique as in the golf clubs, where they would wrap the front fibers of the bow around to the back, and they would create the compressive strength of the close side of the bow to you when you're shooting. They created the compression by wrapping the fibers around the front and stretching. And so it's very interesting, and these were like 70 layers of carbon fiber to make these bows. And they developed the tool, etc., and we started making this. And one day, we're everything is going, we're in production, the tool is there, and at this time, working with carbon fiber was much more difficult than it is today. Today, you can just vacuum cure the carbon fiber, but in those days you had to heat it up. The resins required high heat, and so the tool was very big, very heavy. It had big ports in it where water would flow through, etc., and on and on and on. And then electrical ports, which would heat the tool up, and you could only make three at a time, and then cool it down, and then put the next set of layers in, 70 layers of carbon fiber, etc. And so I get a call one day from my manufacturer. They're out in California, and I hear a bunch of noise and talking. They're on a speakerphone. And this company that was doing the manufacturing, they were making struts and landing gear and things like that for military aircraft, and the military came for an inspection one day. And they came around to my work, the archery equipment. They said, "What's this? What are you doing here?" And they said, "Oh, we're making this carbon fiber archery equipment for this guy up in Minnesota." And the military then went to examine it, and they said, "This stuff is so high performance that we're not going to allow you to make it and sell it to the public. Because literally, you could take," and we were making the longbow. The next version was a short recurve bow, called after the Scathian design, the Mideastern designs, very big recurve, very high frequency, short bows with extreme high velocity with aramid tip arrows. And you could walk through, you could break this down into a piece about a foot long, three-piece bow. It was a breakdown bow. And a pack of arrows, of 500 arrows, and you could put it under your pants leg and walk through an x-ray detector at an airport. And this was not the goal, but this was just the reality. And so the military came in and they shut it down and they said, you can't do this anymore. I'm like, what? You can't be serious. Because I was doing them for the sport industry of archery and for the hunting industry. And so anyway, I wanted to tell this story just because it's just another example. It seems like every time I do something, I come out on the cutting edge far beyond anything anybody has done before, and then somebody comes in to shut it down for some reason. Anyway, so this business actually went on for a while, and it continued the making the old English archery equipment, authentic equipment, and then I became more gainfully employed with the university teaching job, with the electronics teaching and all of that. And so I kind of let the bow business go by the wayside, stopped doing that because it was very time intensive, etc. Just to give you an idea of the longbows, these were beautifully finished. Like I say, there were people, I got a call from a guy who bought one, and he said every year on his birthday, he takes it out, strings it up, and shoots it once, and then he takes it back and puts it up on his wall. This is the prize level of work that I was doing. And like I say, I was going to art festivals selling my archery equipment as artwork. And these were high level. These were national level artwork where they did like the duck paintings and the outdoor scenes and the Terry Redland type of artwork. My bow archery equipment was there. I had the Indian style with the silver fox quiver and all of this. I mean, it was fabulous artwork, and people bought this literally not to use, but as a wall hanging. Okay, so anyway, enough of that, but I just wanted to talk about this time frame, a very interesting time. And also, of course, this is the time frame where the CIA, this is something, too, that all of this went underground, the NASA, the Goddard, the other thing I learned after time frame, after 1995, after Hale-Bopp had been officially discovered by Hale and Bopp, what I learned is that the CIA, intelligence agencies, etc., never informed the Tier 2 scientists about this Planet X object that was on its way towards Earth. They did not tell the Tier 2 scientists, and these are the scientists that worked at Goddard, etc., and even in Los Alamos, and there's a level of, there was just like, these people worked together, but the Tier 1 scientists had the better equipment, better use of equipment. There would be times when, for example, in Haleakala in Hawaii, where they have the big infrared telescope installations for observing from outer space, that the standard scientists that were working there, some night in would come a bunch of scientists and throw them out to use the equipment. And they didn't know what these people were doing or what they were using the equipment for. But it was very clear that these people had priority when they wanted to do something. And so anyway, they did not tell the Tier 2 scientists. And that's why when Hale-Bopp was discovered, I got a call from my friend, said, hey, there's this new big comet that was just discovered. So I go to the phone and I call up Goddard. And to the, as I said before, the secretary answers, hello, Jim, what's going on? And I could hear this screaming and pandemonium in the background. And I mean, after, you know, dozens and dozens, maybe even 100 calls to Goddard that I had made over the years, I had never heard anything like this. It's always quiet. You never hear even anybody talking in a low voice. And it was just screaming and pandemonium. I said, what's going on? She said, "It's Hale-Bopp. It's Hale-Bopp. It's huge." And she repeated, "It's huge." And I'm like, "What do you mean? It's like a big story? It's national press." And then I realized, no, physically, Hale-Bopp is huge. So these astronomers did not know anything about it until it was officially discovered by Hale and Bopp. And then, of course, instantly they would have known that it was on a direct collision course with Earth, and thus all the pandemonium going on at Goddard that particular day. And so that was July 15th, 1995, which was during this epoch. So just another kind of a explanation of timing here. I was teaching at the university, the state university system, physics and astronomy. And then I got a job offer from a telecommunications company, and I finally went there to work, you know, huge increase in pay, a very stable job, very high security. And I literally worked there 15 years to the day until I've officially retired. And so once again, providing me with a very good position. I quick want to mention also that the CIA, all of the Iran-Contra stuff that had been going on was starting to come to light during this time frame. I also want to mention that during this time frame, I went to Mexico to survey. I surveyed Chichen Itza, and this is with transit equipment, surveying, traditional surveying. This is before digital and GPS, of course. And so I surveyed Chichen Itza, Tulum, Uxmal, Mayan ruins. And what I was doing was getting, because these cities had been built on the old gridwork of north, south, east, and west, the old polar coordinates. And so what I discovered is I triangulated, and I discovered that the old North Pole was in Ontario, north of the state of Michigan, up in Hudson Bay. And so this leads also into current work that's actually going on in the last couple of years by a friend of mine, Mark Gaffney. Other people are jumping on this also. It was originally talked about by a guy named Hapgood, who nobody believed. They wrote him off as a quack, etc. And so it was after the discovery of Hale-Bopp where I had a lot of attention. I had a web page that was getting millions of hits literally per week as the result of the discovery of Hale-Bopp. And of course, this was a crazy time. I'm not going to go into it on this show. I'm just about out of time here. Also, it's a time when experimentation, I started working with the Russian scientists at the University of Novosibirsk. So all of these topics I'll pick up next week. A huge amount of work, just very productive work in this time frame leading into the mid-1990s. My webpage, jmccsci.com, also the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com, and remember to use the coupon code JMCC for a 10% discount. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.